KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Lyme disease starts with a tiny tick bite, but it's become the center of a big controversy. While it can usually be treated with antibiotics early on, many sufferers say it's often misdiagnosed and mistreated. And for years, a battle has raged between some patient advocates and the scientific community. That controversy is the subject of a new book called Cure Unknown: Inside the Lyme Epidemic, and a new documentary film called Under Our Skin. We'll talk with the book's author and one of the film's producers about Lyme disease and the intriguing controversy that surrounds it. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. In the early 1990s, Pamela Weintraub and her family moved from New York City to what they thought would be an idyllic suburban existence in Westchester County, New York. It didn't work out that way. One by one, her family got sick. The diagnosis took years to figure out: Lyme disease. And her family's experience prompted an unusual journey into a controversy surrounding the treatment of a condition that goes on to this day. "I was a patient and a mother," she writes, "but also a science journalist when my family got swept up in the Lyme War." The Lyme disease debate involves both how the condition gets diagnosed and what kind of treatment is appropriate. Some patient advocates argue the disease is grossly misdiagnosed and that traditional scientific treatment regimens are often faulty. The scientific community has often rejected those concerns. Controversy has sparked heated debate and even investigation by the Connecticut Attorney General. Pamela Weintraub has now written a book about her experience called Cure Unknown: Inside the Lyme Epidemic. She joins us now. Good morning.
Hi there.
And joining us as well is Chris Newby. She is one of the producers of a new film about the Lyme disease controversy. She herself has dealt with Lyme disease. The film is called Under Our Skin. It was recently shown at the Mill Valley Film Festival. Chris, good morning.
Good morning.
Happy to have you both here. We'll hear a short excerpt from Chris's film in just a moment. But before we get into that, I think we need to do kind of a Lyme disease 101. Starts with a tiny tick bite. Take us from there, Pam Weintraub.
Well, yes. Most people who get Lyme disease are bitten by a tick that is a nymph. It's about the size of the head of a pin, and it's usually in the Ixodes family. And the tick transmits a spirochete that's called Borrelia burgdorferi, which starts out in the skin, disseminates through the blood, and ultimately gravitates to tissues, to joints, to nervous tissue, to the brain, to the heart, and other tissues. And if Lyme disease is not treated very early, usually in the rash phase, if you even see a rash, and while the numbers are contested, easily 50% of people never see a rash, whether they have it or not. If it's not treated early, you can go on to a later, much more intractable and more difficult stage of disease. The disease can cause, because of where it gravitates, it can cause terrible neurological problems, cognitive problems, it can cause pain syndromes, and it can cause arthritis, heart problems. So it's a very serious issue.
But the first thing to understand about it is that it is a bacterium, and therefore it can be treated with antibiotics. I mean, if caught, if diagnosed, it's something that treatment can get
absolutely
after.
If you diagnose Lyme disease early in the game, it is usually always curable, usually always no big deal. And that early diagnosis is key.
And that's also, Chris Newby, part of what is so problematic, right? This question of diagnosis, because it is not as simple as one would think.
Well, if you don't see the rash and you don't see the tick, it resembles the flu in the beginning stages. My husband and I went on a trip to Martha's Vineyard for a week, and 2 weeks later came down with horrible flu-like symptoms with neurological involvement. We had blurry vision. Every joint ached. We were so weak we had to, like, crawl up the stairs on our hands and knees, you know, but the doctors kept on thinking it was the flu.
And that's in part because the rash doesn't always show up. The blood test doesn't always give you a definitive verdict.
Well, and the rash can be doesn't necessarily hurt, and it can be in a place that you don't see it. If it's on your backside or under your hair, you won't see it.
Also, the rash is popularized as a bullseye.
Right.
And often the rash – usually the rash is not a bullseye. Often it's not an oval. It can be a very odd-looking mottled red rash with areas of white clearing that expands. And a lot of people, including many physicians, don't recognize that as a Lyme rash, although they should. Beyond that, the only way to catch Lyme disease in that really early stage is through the rash. If you're waiting for a positive blood test, then you're not in the early stages of Lyme disease anymore.
And in the meantime, it can often be misdiagnosed or people think that something else might be going on, as Chris was just describing. So let's listen to just a short 30-second or so excerpt from the film that Chris is one of the producers for. Again, it's called Under Our Skin. And it's just a montage of people talking about what they heard when they went to see the doctor.
Over the last 12 years, I've been diagnosed off and on with lupus.
Chronic fatigue syndrome, Crohn's disease.
Fibromyalgia.
Lupus, fibromyalgia, MS.
Fibromyalgia. Rheumatoid arthritis.
Doctors thought I had ADD.
Chronic fatigue syndrome.
Chronic fatigue syndrome.
Parkinson's disease.
Syphilis. Multiple sclerosis.
MS to ALS to nothing.
They were pulling anything out of their hat they could think of.
Doctor after doctor after doctor after doctor after doctor. Misdiagnosing or putting her on some medication that didn't work, or just thought we were both nuts.
An excerpt from the new film Under Our Skin, which describes Lyme disease and the controversy that's often associated with its both its diagnosis and its treatment. We'll get to that controversy in just a moment. But when you hear that, Chris Newby, what's striking about it is you had these severe flu-like symptoms, but it can be more than that. You heard a series of serious neurological conditions that people thought were originally what they were diagnosed with, ranging from ALS to multiple sclerosis to Parkinson's disease.
Yeah, and a lot of times those don't manifest themselves till you're 4, 5, 6 months into the disease, and you don't necessarily connect them to your trip to Martha's Vineyard or Cape Cod. So that's problematic too. And then we have a healthcare system now where the frontline physicians spend maybe 10 minutes with you and they go on to the next patient and they don't really like look at the whole patient and get a really thorough history.
Is that something that is a particular problem in different parts of the country that aren't as exposed? We associate Lyme disease primarily with where it started, Lyme, Connecticut, in the Northeast and in the upper Midwest where this deer tick is particularly prevalent. But is this a problem with physician awareness, generally speaking, especially in parts of California where it might not be as commonly seen?
I would say so. And there have been cases reported in all 50 states. And when we were doing this filming, we went from Alaska down to San Diego, across to Florida, and all up and down the eastern seaboard. And, you know, our conclusion is it's everywhere. Iowa, too. We went to a funeral service for a dozen people who died of Lyme. And I think there is this myth that it's a northeastern disease, but it's everywhere now. And it's anybody who travels is vulnerable.
The other issue is that there are layers of complexity here. For example, the Lone Star tick, which was started out in the South in areas like Missouri, now is spread all the way up the East Coast through up through Maine, all the way out through the Midwest. The Lone Star tick carries another spirochete, another Borrelia. It's not Lyme disease. It's a Lyme mimic. It causes the rash. It causes all the symptoms of Lyme disease. And it responds to treatment by antibiotics. But you will never test positive for Lyme disease because, in fact, it's not actually, quote, Lyme disease, unquote.
So is Lyme disease many things? I mean, should you think of it almost more as a syndrome of
I wouldn't use the word syndrome because that implies that you don't really know the cause. I would say it's more of a complex of various spirochetal infections, for example, in the Northeast. They found that 20% of the spirochetes that they thought were Borrelia burgdorferi are really another spirochete, and also other co-infections within the ticks. For example, very prevalent is the malaria-like infection babesiosis. There are the intracellular infections, ehrlichiosis and anaplasmosis. Scientists are investigating Bartonella or Bartonella-like diseases. And all of these diseases co-inhabit the tick with Lyme disease. In addition to this, the a number of the mainstream university scientists that I interviewed told me that they believe that for every pathogen inside the tick that we know of, there's another one that we haven't yet defined. And so you've got a very complicated situation here, and that's part of the problem when people try to simplify something that's so nuanced.
Pamela Weintraub, the author of a new book called Cure Unknown, Inside the Lyme Epidemic. Her entire family wound up getting Lyme disease. Chris Newby joins us as well. She's one of the producers of a new film called Under Our Skin. She and her husband also contracted Lyme disease. Let's begin to talk now about the controversy, because it's well documented in both the book and your film about the intensity that surrounds this condition. Pam Weintraub, first, on what the heart of that is about, because it appears that there is a great reluctance, and we should add at this point that we invited a number of doctors to participate in our conversation this morning who have a more traditional view of how this disease should be treated, but they declined to do so. But describe for us what the tension is, I guess, in how this disease is treated.
Well, I would say the tension is twofold, and the first one is, what is Lyme disease? And just to get to the heart of it, as it really concerns people on the street, is how do you diagnose it? And the Infectious Diseases Society of America, or IDSA, has a very restrictive view of what it is. They view early Lyme disease as the rash. If you don't get the rash, they want you to get one of a few very blatant, measurable signs of Lyme disease. For example, the flu that Chris described, that she had, the symptoms my family had at first wouldn't qualify. You need to have grossly swollen knees or blatantly inflamed meninges or a nerve so damaged that damage can be detected on an electromyogram. If you can document that damage, then you need to pass a very specific blood test that looks for a pattern of antibody bands. The problem is that just even forgetting about the complexity of other spirochetes and other co-infections, there are 100 strains of Borrelia burgdorferi in the U.S. Each one has got a different antibody pattern. There are scientists now at Stony Brook who are looking at that complexity and trying to find another much more specific test. But meanwhile, the conventional people are saying that you only have Lyme disease if you pass their circumscribed test. And the other issue has to do with persistence. Does the spirochete survive the standard antibiotic treatment?
So the first problem is too narrow, Chris Newby, a definition of what the disease is. And so unless you sort of can be checked off on a particular diagnostic test, you don't get treatment?
Right. And pretty draconian in the objective signs. And, you know, medicine is more of an art than a science. And you need to look at the total patient and the patterns of the disease and make a decision. And one of the problems with the IDSA guidelines is by the time you pass the hurdle of the two-tiered test, you're 3 to 4 months into the disease, and you can no longer be cured by 2 weeks of antibiotics in most cases, especially if co-infections are involved.
So why the reluctance? Why the reluctance by the organization you referred to, the Infectious Disease Society of America, to be so cautious, I guess, in their response to the disease?
Well, that was a central question for me because it's unintuitive. If you have a group of researchers that make money off a disease, why would they be saying it's easy to treat, easy to cure? Because when you look at conflicts of interest in medicine, mostly you find that, oh, they've been getting money from the big pharmaceuticals to push a certain drug. And in this case, IDSA is saying, oh, you know, you only need 2 to 4 weeks of antibiotics and then you're good to go. Well, what I realized when I started following the money trail is the money in Lyme isn't in the cure, which is 2 weeks of very inexpensive off-patent antibiotics. The money is in the development of a vaccine for big pharma that you can charge a patient every year. You know, anyone who goes outside in the summer is at risk of getting Lyme any age, and you can charge them for a vaccine every year. So early on, the effort went into the vaccine and not the cure. And what happened was they developed the vaccine before they totally understood the mechanism of infection for the disease. And the vaccine wasn't particularly effective. And they ended up defining the disease for the benefit of the vaccine and not the treatment.
But that would implies the sort of conspiratorial view and of physicians, Pam Weintraub, doesn't it? That these physicians care more about developing a vaccine than they do about treating a patient.
I prefer not to go down the path of conspiracy theories. And I would simply say that money itself flows in a certain direction, just like gravity, you know, sort of works. And that if there are grants and money's flowing to support a certain research direction, and if your lab is constantly getting monies for that point of view, that it may just be natural to go in that direction. And I think that these conflicts of interest, which have been very well defined by the Attorney General Blumenthal of Connecticut, are systemic and institutional. It's not a question of these people going in a room and saying, let's cook up a plan. It's just the way... It's easy to see how this evolved without...
We should mention by way of reference, I mentioned it in the introduction, but Chris Newby, fill me in if I don't give enough information here. Essentially, what's going on in Connecticut right now is the state attorney general is investigating how these guidelines were formed by the Infectious Disease Society of America and whether or not there were, as you suggest there may be, conflicts of interest, whether or not that group was too protective of their desire to develop a vaccine and therefore issued guidelines that were too restrictive. And that's an ongoing investigation now, correct?
Correct. And, well, actually, there was somewhat of a settlement where IDSA didn't admit guilt, but they've agreed to reassemble a panel without conflicts of interest
and
look into rewriting that. But what we found is if you look at the 14 IDSA guideline authors, 12 of 14 had received money from vaccine companies or test kit companies or owned patents or owned companies that were going to market test kits. And so, you know, I have no trouble with people innovating in medicine and profiting from that. But it is a problem if you're writing guidelines that endorse those products and you don't disclose that.
There also seems to be some debate, Pam Weintraub, about whether or not this disease is chronic, whether or not it can continue. You write toward the end of your book sort of what the dilemma is. I'll just read this short excerpt. The labyrinthine science of Lyme disease is a brain bender. One group of studies suggests spirochetes, that's the bacteria, can survive the standard treatment. An opposite set suggests the microbes always die. One set of papers shows evidence that spirochetes may hide or change form when faced with a stressor like an antibiotic. Alternate papers dismiss these factors, deeming them irrelevant to the actual course of the disease. So is the science unclear at this point?
Well, I would say that the science is becoming clearer and clearer. To really get to the bottom of this, I decided to leave the fight behind and to go to the university academicians who were really working with the organism but uninvolved in the fight with the patients to see if I could get an unpolitical perspective on this. And I did come to a great understanding by speaking to these researchers. There's a Dr. Stephen Barthold at UC Davis who worked at Yale previously for 25 years, who's done tremendous work and has found that that the spirochetes, after treatment, become dormant and live in a quiescent form, generally inside the collagen of the tissue, and that they then after a certain time can be transmitted back to other organisms, and they can convert back to he's working on this, but finding that likely they can convert back into living motile spirochetes, and this probably explains a lot of the persistence that's going on and why patients keep remitting and relapsing and why antibiotics can't cure them, because these spirochetes are just not multiplying fast enough to take in the antibiotics. So I think that science is slowly coming up with answers, but we're going to have to turn our backs on the fight and look at the science in order to get to the bottom of this.
And is there a growing consensus then that the idea of taking 2 weeks of antibiotics and you're good to go, that that's now dated, Chris Newby, and that the idea of a longer course of antibiotics and that you may need to return to that from time to time over the course of your lifetime, is that becoming the new view of how this disease is treated?
No, frustratingly enough. I just think that when the new IDSA guidelines were published, they took on the force of law, and insurance companies have found it convenient to stick with that 4 weeks because they don't want to pay for longer courses. And also, I think there has been a climate of fear with the IDSA panel that the IDSA panel has helped generate, where frontline physicians are afraid to deviate out of that because they don't want to be called to the mat by their institutions for overprescribing antibiotics.
Doctors are very afraid. And I know, for example, I have a friend who was diagnosed with Lyme disease after being diagnosed with multiple sclerosis for 5 years. And she is very, very sick. And she is being treated by a physician in her community who is not known for being a Lyme literate doctor, but is just her doctor. And he is treating her longer term, but he is very afraid to buck the insurance company. He has told her she has to pay out of pocket for this medicine because he doesn't want to be identified as being one of the doctors who will go this alternate course. He's his story is very common.
Pam Weintraub is the author of a new book about Lyme disease called Cure Unknown: Inside the Lyme Epidemic. She joins us this hour along with Chris Newby, one of the producers of a film about the Lyme disease controversy called Under Our Skin. We're going to open up our phone lines in just a moment, too. Let's go ahead and give you that number if you have a question for either Chris Newby or Pam Weintraub. Here's the number. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us your thoughts or questions at forum@kqed.org. It's ongoing for your families both, right? This is a lifetime deal. Pam Weintraub?
Well, I hope it's not going to be a lifetime deal, but my older son still has some symptoms, and my younger son was rebitten by a tick in last summer, and because we saw the rash, we treated it early, and I thought, wow, that's great, but he actually failed the early treatment, and he got pretty sick again.
And Chris Newby, for you and your husband, is it something that you will continue to live with, do you think?
Well, my husband, luckily, is free of symptoms, so he's my role model. Every time I go off antibiotics for more than 3 months, the creeping neurological symptoms come back, so I've had to go back on antibiotics. But I'm hopeful if we can open up the thinking and put some money into the research that there'll be better cures. I mean, I just think long-term antibiotics are not a cure. They're sort of a blunt instrument, but they do take people who are completely disabled and dysfunctional and make them functional human beings with a good quality of living again.
And some of those symptoms can be really acute. Some of the people that are portrayed in your film are really completely disabled.
Oh, yes. And, you know, I think that's not that uncommon. After we went all around the United States and interviewed, you know, hundreds and hundreds of patients, sometimes they're not as visible. A lot of times it's an invisible disease, but they can be very serious and debilitating.
Chris Newby, producer of the film Under Our Skin, and Pam Weintraub, author of Cure Unknown: Inside the Lyme Epidemic. If you have questions or concerns about Lyme disease and about how it's treated, we invite you to call us now, and we'll take your calls when we come back for our break. Here's the number again. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us your questions at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. Back with more with Pam Weintraub and Chris Newby in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, Lyme disease, how it's diagnosed, how it's treated, some of the challenges that are inherent both for patients and for the medical community in that. Our guests include Pam Weintraub, who has a new book about this called Cure Unknown: Inside the Lyme Epidemic. She and her husband, along with her two sons, have contended with Lyme disease for a number of years. We're joined also by Chris Newby, who is one of the producers of a new film about Lyme disease called Under Our Skin. She and her husband also have contended with Lyme disease. We welcome your calls and thoughts on this subject, too, you can join us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Let's go to our first caller this morning. It's Gabrielle, who joins us in San Francisco. Gabrielle, go ahead.
Hi. I am a chronically infected Lyme disease patient. I grew up in the Bay Area in Marin County, and I've been living with Lyme disease for 20 years now. I just read Pamela Weintraub's book and this summer and wanted to thank her for the information she's trying to get out there. I remember being bit by a tick sometime between 10 and 12, but I had only heard of Lyme disease in the context of the northeastern seaboard, and I remember thinking when I got bit by that tick that, gosh, I wonder if this could give me Lyme disease. But living on the West Coast, I was never had any flu-like symptoms. I never got the bullseye rash. I never got any of those initial telltale signs. 20 years later, I was diagnosed in 2005 after dealing with severely debilitating other chronic illnesses for a number of years. So I just wanted to, again, thank Pamela and Chris for the work they're doing trying to get information out and stress the need, the urgent need for education and information. Like, even today, there's just so much misinformation out there.
Gabrielle, thanks. Thanks for the call and the observation. Sounds like one of the many people from your film, Chris Newby. I mean, that sort of complex series of symptoms and many, many years before a definitive diagnosis was made.
Yeah, and a lot of times they're given misdiagnoses of syndromes like chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia, and once they get that label, they don't keep looking for answers. So, I mean, one offshoot of the film, I hope, is that people will reconsider a Lyme diagnosis.
Arjuman, sorry if I'm not pronouncing that correctly, and Gilroy joins us next. Arjuman, go ahead.
Yes, how are you doing, doctor?
Good, thanks.
My name is Arjuman, and I have a question regarding one of the very closest family relative who I know that probably having some sort of symptoms for the past couple of years. The only thing I need to know, I just don't want to go into the detail, I just need to know there are so many doctors and facilities out there now promising that they cure and they have, you know, the diagnosis for the Lyme disease. But we don't know where to go. We don't know where to look and what will be the proper guidance for people like us or people like, you know, people who have some suffering from Lyme disease and don't even know where to go, where to look, because since this is so ambiguous, so many people know about it and everybody like promising. Need to know proper guidance. Where should we go to treat Lyme disease?
Arjuman, thank you. Thanks for the call. Thoughts on that, Pam Weintraub, about where you go for information, well, general guidance when you might have to contend with this disease?
First of all, if you have a situation that's very confusing or complicated, I would urge you, in addition to seeking a Lyme literate doctor, to seek doctors who can do a differential diagnosis for many, many other conditions. Just as you have to be careful that you may have been misdiagnosed with something else and you really have Lyme, you also have to be really sure that you don't have – there are so many diseases out there. Lyme is one of them. If you have done that differential diagnosis and everything else – you know, other things have been ruled out and you're sure because you don't maybe have – you don't fit totally within the classic mold that you have a Lyme disease, you should go to a and you haven't been able to get help from your mainstream doctors, then you would need to cross the line to a Lyme literate physician who would be willing to look at a more inclusive definition of Lyme disease, and if they feel that you have Lyme disease, may be willing to treat you with longer courses of antibiotics and look for other infections as well.
We mentioned earlier that we had invited a number of physicians who do take a more narrow view of how the disease can best be diagnosed and best be treated, and that we were unable to do so, that we had invited a number of physicians here in the Bay Area, but they had declined to participate. But we are joined now by Eugene Shapiro. He's professor of pediatrics, epidemiology, and public health at Yale School of Medicine. And he was on the panel that wrote the guidelines that we were talking about earlier, the infectious disease Society of America guidelines, which initially proposed a more narrow course of treatment. Dr. Shapiro, thanks for calling in.
Sure.
What's your view at this point? We mentioned earlier that the ISDA, or IDSA, the organization you are a part of, was now looking again at the guidelines. Are you revising your approach in terms of how you think this disease can best be treated?
Well, what I want to emphasize is that there are more than 25 years of good scientific study out there. Many studies that the guidelines are based on, and what is happening now is a review, which in fact happens routinely every couple of years, of all the guidelines put out by the Infectious Disease Society of America. I do not expect there to be any changes because the data continue to show that that the original guidelines were based on had a very sound scientific basis.
So, is it your sense at this point that, despite the stories that you have heard that are documented in Pam Weintraub's book and in Chris Newby's film, of people who have continued to struggle with this for any number of years, that a simple course of antibiotics for a limited period of time is still the best course of action to follow?
Well, let me separate. Let me make a couple things clear.
Sure.
Our goal is to do the best for patients. What we want is for patients to feel better and to be cured. So I think that there are some misperceptions when somebody hears us, some of us say that Lyme disease is not the problem, is not the same as say is a lot of the patients feel like they're being dismissed and being told, oh, you know, you're crazy or something. That is not what I feel bad for those patients, and I don't and cannot dispute that they're having exactly the symptoms that they're complaining about. But I think what we do need to do is to base our approach to it on sound scientific data.
So is it your continuing belief that people who have had these ongoing symptoms sometimes for decades, not that those symptoms aren't real, you would accept the reality of their experience, you're just saying it's not likely to be Lyme disease?
Right. And, I mean, this has been studied extensively. In many, many, many different centers, not just one study, but many. And it turns out the majority of such patients that have been evaluated have no evidence of ever having had Lyme disease. You would think they have chronic Lyme disease. You would need evidence of either having had it in the past or currently having it, but the majority don't. Now, there is a subgroup of patients who clearly did have Lyme disease and go on to continue to have symptoms. There's no question about that. We call it, for the first 6 months, it's called post Lyme disease symptoms, and then if it persists more than 6 months, we call it post Lyme disease syndrome. And in fact, there have been at least five double-blind randomized clinical trials, the most rigorous type of scientific study conducted by a variety of different investigators, including, by the way, an investigator from Columbia University who is a member of ILADS and is a proponent of long-term therapy. And the conclusion of all of them is that long-term antibiotics are not beneficial. Now, it's not that people's symptoms don't change. In fact, in some of the studies, up 40% of the people who got placebo got better, improved or completely got better. But the point is that there's no evidence that these antibiotics have any beneficial effect over that of placebo. And the other critically important point is that these long-term antibiotics have many detrimental side effects, both for the individual who is receiving them and for society at large.
Professor Shapiro, let me hold you there, if I might, because we want to get other calls in on the line. If you want to stay with us, if you have time to do that, we'll keep you on board.
I have a little time, I do.
Okay, we'll keep you on board, but we want to get other viewpoints and other listener calls as well. But thanks for calling in and adding your perspective. Pam Weintraub, this gets us right back to what you write about, that the difficulties of weighing this, that one study says one thing, one study says another, that it's difficult to sort through. That's your job. As a science journalist, to try to figure this out.
I think that Dr. Shapiro is being too broad in his assessment of these studies. The first study, the one that really has been pivotal in narrowing insurance company coverage, the Klempner study, I'll tell you, Dr. Shapiro knows I interviewed him, but I interviewed many other academics in the mainstream, quite a number of them. On the QT, told me that that study was just just insurance company medicine. That first study, the Klempner study, had 75% of the patients were patients who had failed treatment for early Lyme disease. Many of them were entered into the study because they had the rash. That's how you really define early Lyme disease. The point is that patients that fail standard treatment for early Lyme disease are by definition outliers because most patients don't fail treatment.
So your point, just
so
we can be...
So they're an unusual group.
So just to be clear on what you're saying, that this study was focused on people who were already difficult to treat. So it's not a fair representation.
That's,
is that your point of whether long-term therapy
yes.
would work?
And then I will mention the other studies. One was by Krupp and the other was by Fallon. The Krupp study found that in terms of fatigue, patients that got additional treatment actually did have a resolution of their fatigue, although not their cognitive problems. However, she concluded that the side effects of the antibiotics were such that that it didn't warrant extra treatment. And Fallon likewise found some kind of effect. I think the reason for the effect is unclear. The other thing is the Klempner study where he had looked for signs of active infection by doing PCR by doing all kinds of tests, and he says he found nothing. And these studies are problematic.
Let me ask one other point, though, that Dr. Shapiro raises, Chris Newby, which is, and that's something that you hear commonly, and probably every parent has heard at one point or another, you don't want kids to be on antibiotics forever. That breeds other super bugs, that there are lots of problems with antibiotic resistance if you overprescribe them. Isn't that a valid concern that Dr. Shapiro brings up?
Yes, but if the alternative is a debilitating neurological disease similar to MS or Parkinson's or ALS, you know, that's a decision that's easy to make. And so, you know, with the IDSA guidelines, I mean, I think the big flaw with them is they were written by almost 100% academic researchers, and stakeholders in these guidelines were not allowed to participate. So that's physicians who treat Lyme on the front lines and treat these chronically ill people for years and have, you know, some of them have treated 7,000 to 10,000 Lyme patients were not included. And this is valuable information. This group of academic researchers calls patient feedback anecdotes. And I say that's evidence that needs to be combined with the academic research.
Dr. Shapiro, let me get you in for a brief response, and then I have to get back to our other callers. But you heard, I'm sure, both what Chris Newby is saying about the need to get other feedback besides just from academicians, and also Pam Weintraub's a central point that the studies to date have certain flaws built in because they didn't look at a broad enough population of long-term Lyme disease sufferers.
Well, I mean, I think that what the studies did look at were the people that part of the problem was that they required some evidence of Lyme diseases. And as I told you, the majority of patients that are diagnosed with chronic Lyme disease, in fact, have no evidence of ever having had Lyme disease currently or in the past.
But isn't that part of the difficulty that it's hard to get that evidence, that some of it is based on
like
clinical observations as opposed to...
There's no evidence that they have it, but somehow a Lyme-literate doctor knows that they have it. I mean, I think you have to base it on scientific data. Now, I will be the first to admit the doctors are very bad at dealing with patients with chronic symptoms.
Yeah.
So I think it's very difficult to deal with that. And I also agree with Chris that if the decision is between chronic long-term antibiotics or multiple sclerosis, obviously you're going to choose antibiotics. But the point of these studies were to look at to try to answer those questions. And Dr. Fallon's study, for example, he targeted to enroll 47 patients with chronic Lyme disease. He ended up with fewer than he targeted. I think it was something like 37. He tried 45. He ended up with 37. To get those 37 patients, he screened something like 3,300 patients or more to end up with only those, because so many of the patients that they were seeing had no evidence of Lyme disease.
Well,
so it's not that they don't have problems or symptoms. It's just that there's little evidence that Lyme disease – there's no evidence that Lyme disease is the cause. So
Pam Weintraub, you're shaking your head as Dr. Shapiro is talking about the question of evidence.
It's just that they didn't have the evidence that met the very restrictive standards of the IDSA. I mean, then that gets into
IDSA again is the Infectious Disease
Society.
Yeah,
that gets into circular thinking about what is Lyme disease. Dr. Fallon was trying to get the very tip of the pyramid, and I know that's so because I spoke to him. I don't think that he felt that none of the other patients had Lyme disease. He was just trying to get those for which the evidence was absolutely incontrovertible. And when you have a situation where there are shades of gray, you have to admit it.
Let's get some callers back engaged in our conversation who would like to pose their questions about Lyme disease and how best to treat it. Dave in Corte Madera joins us next. Dave, go ahead.
Hi. I was bitten by a tick about 3 months ago, and I went to my doctor. I never got the rash, and I have had a few symptoms. I've had some headaches and a little achy, but, you know, I'm 42, and sometimes you just get a little achy. Anyway, my doctor suggested I get a titer test. I haven't heard you say anything about a titer test. I haven't had a chance to go to the lab yet to get the blood work done, but I wanted to hear your comments on how effective that is at diagnosing Lyme disease or what I can do just to assure myself or feel comfortable that I haven't contracted it.
Dave, thanks for the call and question. Pam Weintraub, do you know about that particular test?
Well, I think that your doctor is probably talking about an ELISA test followed by a Western blot. And these tests are very problematic because in the first stage, which is considered a screening test, many patients that would actually pass the second stage, the Western blot, fail. So you're missing a lot of patients in that first test, and then in the second test, the Western blot, it's problematic because, of course, if you have the 5 of 10 bands designated by the CDC, then you've got great evidence for Lyme disease. But there are Lyme patients that don't pass that test for another number of reasons, including the fact that some strains of the spirochete lack some of the antibody bands that are required in that test. And because there are 100 strains in the U.S., there are some scientists, like, for instance, at Stony Brook, who are looking for much more sophisticated 21st century technologies to give us answers as to diagnosis. So you can get the test, and if you're positive, then you have very good evidence. But if you're negative, it doesn't really, in my opinion, mean that you don't have Lyme disease.
Rob writes in this email, I'm interested in your guest comments on the New England Journal of Medicine studies from 2001 showing no benefit of 90 days of antimicrobial therapy in over 100 patients with chronic Lyme disease. That's one of the studies that is often cited in this, the study from the New England Journal. What's your view on that, Chris Newby?
I think that's the – isn't that the Klempner study?
No, that's Scare study. And that study is very problematic, like all of the other studies that due to this very narrow definition of Lyme disease in the first place. So if you have a very restrictive definition and you apply it to these people, then obviously only a very restrictive number of people are going to pass your test. I do want to add one thing, that Johns Hopkins recently did a study on the two-tier Lyme disease tests. They found that about 75% of the people one way or another didn't pass those Lyme disease tests. So
the test is very bad.
So you have to cast a skeptical eye on all of those studies.
I want to keep us moving along here and get in as many calls as we can. But briefly, Dr. Shapiro, on this question, it does seem like that's a problem. If the restrictiveness of how you are diagnosed is so small, almost by definition, you're not going to be able to widen that out so that people are going to show positive effects from treatment.
Well, first of all, the patients that have false negative tests on those it's well recognized. It's because the rash occurs before you develop antibodies. So the vast majority of patients who are negative, even though they have Lyme disease, in fact, have the rash, and it's early Lyme disease. These studies study patients with late Lyme disease. 100% of patients with Lyme arthritis will have antibodies because it takes 3 or 4 weeks for the antibodies to develop, whereas the rash develops 10, 14, 20 days the bite. So that's part of the problem. But, you know, certainly we can use better tests, but I would disagree. The other point is that there is no definition of chronic Lyme disease according to the Lyme literate doctors. The definition of chronic Lyme disease is, I say you have chronic Lyme disease. I would be very interested in a definition. One of the problems with studying chronic Lyme disease, frankly, is that even the Lyme literate, so-called Lyme literate doctors don't have a definition other than the fact that they say it's Lyme disease. So as a scientist, I think we need to try to I'm all for getting the right answer. If there were scientific evidence that long-term antibiotics provided more benefit than harm, I would jump right on the bandwagon.
Is there that evidence? Pam Weintraub?
Absolutely not.
I'm delighted to hear Dr. Shapiro say that he would like to have more evidence, because I would also like to see much more research. There is no question but that patients who have chronic Lyme disease or who have persistent symptoms of Lyme disease after the standard treatment, and I'm just going to throw that out there as my own personal working definition, that many of them are not cured by long-term antibiotics. The fact is that we do need more research, and we do need other treatments. They may be antibiotic treatments, or they may not be antibiotic treatments. They may be immune treatments. But we do need to get to the bottom of this, because these people are sick, and we need the research for that.
Back to our callers. Grant in San Francisco joins us next. Grant, go ahead.
Thank you very much. I would like your guests and your authors to discuss the challenge that is presented when someone doesn't know they have a kind of Lyme disease or spirochetal infection. They begin to get depressed. They see a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist gives them anti-anxiety drugs, depression drugs, ADD drugs. And then, lo and behold, 4, 3, 5, 6 years later, they realize they have Lyme disease. And it creates the scenario where it's very easy for the primary care physician to deduce that they're suffering from some sort of delusional syndrome. And I am working on a book about this, and I've come across this a lot. It's very easy to just discount the patient as the film says in its tagline, it's all in your head.
Grant, thanks. Thanks for the call and observation. Comments or thoughts? Chris Newby?
Well, it was really interesting. The first time we started filming Lyme patients, we were at a Lyme conference back east, and for 2 days we listened to over 60 Lyme patients. And the thing that was really shocking was almost all of those 60 people had been accused of having psychological problems. So at that point we knew we had a really interesting film. Also, most of them had considered suicide at one time or another because the symptoms are so horrible. You know, I think it's all about information. I think the well of scientific information on Lyme disease has been poisoned by conflicts of interest by this small group of academic researchers. And we need to open it up, have the equivalent of a Manhattan Project to think outside of the box and just get the dialogue going now. I mean, a problem with it now is we have a he said, she said, really polarized scientific discussion. And we don't have a discussion. Nobody's talking. So we need to have conferences that bring the clinicians together with the researchers, and we need to really get better information about what chronic Lyme is.
On that one point, I'm sure all of us would agree, including Dr. Shapiro, who has joined us for the second part of this program, and I do appreciate your calling in. Lots of people calling in with real everyday questions. How can you avoid it? What sprays do you recommend? Is it common in the cities? What part of the country can I get it? Is it true here in California? So forth and so on. Don't have time, unfortunately, to go through them all. But where's the best place to get information in such an amorphous condition with so many possible symptoms, just to get the best information available? Where would you point people to, Pam Weintraub?
Well, I would say that in the beginning, when you think you have a disease, it is really good to start with the mainstream. But if you are cast from doctor to doctor, you get sicker and sicker, and nobody has an answer for you, and you're slowly losing your life, your job, your ability to function, and you have been. You believe you have been exposed to tick-borne disease, then it behooves you. You have no choice but to cross the line and see a Lyme-literate doctor who deals with these patients. And that is where you should go.
You can start. There are a lot of really good resources on the Internet. And I would go to Turn the Corner Foundation, Lyme Disease Association, and LymeNet, and start there.
And Dr. Shapiro, best place for information in your judgment? Dr. Shapiro, guess we lost him.
American Lyme Disease Foundation, ALDF.org, I believe, and or the CDC.gov will have information.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for calling in. Appreciate your participation, Dr. Shapiro. Thanks, too, to Pam Weintraub. Again, her new book is called Cure Unknown Inside the Lyme Epidemic. Cure Unknown Inside the Lyme Epidemic. And Chris Newby, whose film is called Under Our Skin. Film available to see, Chris? If someone wasn't able to get to the local film festivals, where can it still be seen?
So there are many community screenings all across the United States being held. You can go to underourskin.com or you can purchase the DVD.
All right, Chris Newby, thanks very much for being part of our program today. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer this hour, Danny Bringer, and the executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.